I came with a lot of experience in the political scene, as it were. And as you rightly point out, I'd been elected in the UK from time of 23, I think, was the first time I was on a local authority. And I'd been in leadership roles. I'd also followed politics in the UK and worked with the Conservative Party and knew a lot about that. But I also followed Manx politics. I became a commissioner because I thought that was a good route into the Keys, get some experience at base level, and then work into the Keys. Now, the first year I was there, or 10 months, as you rightly point out, slightly less than a year, I worked my socks off. I was in two departments, I was on committees, and I was running around trying to find out how the system worked, what made it tick, so that in the next administration, as I was elected, no one knows where you're going to go at an election, I had gained and garnered some of that experience, and I knew that we were going to lose quite a few experienced members, so there was an opportunity there.
Would you say you're a natural fit for the Department of Environment, Food and Agriculture?
Well, I come from a farming family, but I also have quite a diverse business background. So, yes, I do like that. And I've been involved in agriculture, owned a farm, operated a farm. That's not the main criteria for becoming a minister with a diverse portfolio, but it does help.
Some of your commitment, I would say, to issues associated with the environment and conservation, they have been challenged over the years, haven't they? I mean, last year you wanted to import grey partridges, for example, to the island, saying there was a demand from farmers and landowners to import and maintain flocks of these birds for the purposes of shooting. Some people would see that as a stark contrast to the very notion of nature conservation, though.
Well, it was completely misconstrued. Very mischievous of you, Beth. The situation was that we used to have a very abundant grey partridge population on the island, and controls were introduced 25-30 years ago, and they stopped any shooting because they're a game bird, and the stocks have just dropped down, and I was approached by a number of individuals and farmers. I said, well, you know, if you make it worthwhile by introducing an open season, we'll bring some birds in, and we'll try and re-establish habitat. And there was an opportunity there, a window with the new agri-environment scheme to promote, you know, overwintering stubble, things like this. So that was an incentive. It was the chances of them all being shot, or in some cases not even being shot, was very remote. But it was an incentive to people to do something about it.
With something like that, though, how relatable does that make you to the average voter? If you think of your own personal circumstances and your understanding, for example, of issues like that, it's not something that's normally applicable to the average person here in the Isle of Man.
Well, I think in my role at the moment, I think it's very applicable because it goes across the scene. It's useful to have a foot in all camps, as it were, to find out what goes on. I mean, there's been a big disconnect between what I call conservationists, ecologists, everyone has their own particular agenda. But I think it's very useful to have someone that sits in the middle that has some knowledge of all camps. And in fact, the Manx Wildlife Trust, the new CEO there, he has reached out to a lot of the other organisations, and I get on reasonably well with him. And I think that's been a step forward, because it's been them over here, us over here, or the other way around. And so, yes, I think it's been a useful bridge.
How much do you consider the needs of the average voters, I keep referring to them, when you're driving policy change within government?
Well, I'd like to know what the average voter is. Is it the person on top of the omnibus or whatever? But voters, in my opinion, are very diverse. They have very diverse opinions, and they come from diverse backgrounds. When you're developing policy, it's always crucial to look at all aspects and how it's going to affect everyone, really, across the spectrum. In my department, we're looking at environmental policy or climate change policy. We have to look at the impact it's going to have and whether we're going to get support. You don't drive policy through if you're not going to get any public support or support from your fellow members.
Let's look at some of the other legislation from the past few years. Earlier this year, in fact, the Animal Welfare Bill was thrown out by the House of Keys. That was met with disappointment, naturally, by many quarters. I've read lots of comments about this bill, Mr. Boot, but to quote just one, this is a lazy piece of weak source legislation which essentially just copies rules from across. And so I suppose I have to ask, why such an important piece of legislation wasn't handled with more care.
It was handled with a great amount of care, I can assure you. And if there's one thing that I was really disappointed about in this administration, it was the fact that my fellow members couldn't see through what we were trying to achieve. At the beginning of the administration, Mr. Cretney, who was in the department, chaired a committee forum where we looked at what we required on the island, and then we tried to set that in motion via further public consultation. In the meantime, of course, COVID came along, and our chief vet with Brexit as well, Brexit, COVID, it was a mix of things. We just didn't have the resource to do a bespoke bill, but I kept driving the process because I knew that we should have something in place. We have some legislation in place, but we needed to improve the situation dramatically. And the way forward was, as suggested to me by our legal advisors, to use a bill that would enable us to cherry pick the UK legislation. And it was a four clause bill, and it would have enabled that to happen almost straight away. We could have then worked on a bespoke bill later, but these things take time, and there was no time in this administration to do that. COVID ate a year of this administration. And it's still ongoing now. So I was bitterly disappointed, and I think a lot of people were.
And you say you're disappointed with your political colleagues. What does that say about your relationship with them and your ability to bring them with you?
I think you could make a good point there. Perhaps I should have done more lobbying. But in actual fact, I had done a lot of lobbying, and I thought I had overall support. I'd done one-to-one briefings with people. But on the day, they decided, and afterwards there was an element of buyer's regret. I think some of them did feel that perhaps they'd gone a little bit too far, and they wanted me to bring it back. But sadly, we haven't had time in this administration. So we're using the consultation and what we've done to push that into the next administration. I hope that something will come forward fairly quickly.
I mean, it's all too easy, though, isn't it, to push things to the next administration, to blame COVID, and the next time you might have nothing to do with this.
You're absolutely sure. Absolutely. In terms of where we are, where we'll land after the election, we don't know. I mean, from my perspective, regardless of where I am, I am re-elected, I will obviously support a bill of this nature. But we haven't been pushing things into the next administration deliberately. It's because we can't do everything. And if you think about the beginning of this administration, I remember the Chief Minister going on the radio and what have you, saying it's going to be all about Brexit. Well, my department was fairly and squarely in the middle of that. Fisheries, agricultural products, maintaining markets, access to the fishery, animal welfare, health in terms of exports, that used up an awful lot of time, legislative time from our point of view. I moved something like 800 or 900 pieces of legislation to amend legislation because of the EU acts, and to align with the UK. And we went through this horrible period when we weren't quite sure what was going to happen in the UK, but we had to do everything just in case. Fortunately, we did do it, and it was required because there was a Brexit. But at the same time, we then ran almost straight away into COVID. And from the Council of Ministers' point of view and government point of view, it actually blew a hole in our legislative programme for the initial period of COVID. And, you know, no one's to blame for that. Sadly, it was a virus that attacked us, and we had to do what we could to maintain the status quo and get the country or the nation through the COVID crisis.
Let's talk about a local issue now. In January this year, Peel lost its Isle of Man bank branch. You and your constituency colleague vowed to fight for that branch. You organised a protest, you wrote several letters, all to no avail. I wonder, Mr. Boot, what you would say that says about your impact as an MHK?
I think that we were fighting a losing battle from day one. Mr. Harmer and myself, we met with the senior management in Douglas. We wrote and had correspondence with the senior management in Jersey. And it was fairly obvious that they were treating us with disdain. They had made the decision. There was no way they were going to unravel that decision.
So you did all of the protest and the writing for show then?
It wasn't for show. We thought, well, we'll put up a lot of pressure on and we'll see what happens. I'm a customer of Isle of Man Bank, and I've always been proud to have an Isle of Man checkbook. And I was disgusted, actually, with the way that they treated us. And there wasn't even any concession. We came up with some alternatives, you know, sharing staff, between Castletown or Port Erin, maybe leaving the cash machine institute or deposit facility, but they wouldn't have any of it. We had the, as you rightly point out, we had the public demonstration. There was a petition, I think, of around 3,500 signatures, but it had no impact whatsoever.
But you don't see that as a personal reflection on your abilities as an MHK to fight for something which was so important to the people of Peel?
I think that had government had the ability to intervene in a private company and we hadn't done that, I would have seen that as a failure. But in this case, this is a private entity which has a lot bigger interests off island, and we can try and cajole and we can try and persuade them that they're not being disloyal to their customer base, but certainly at government level, we can't command.
Now, one of the concerns you said you had about the closure of the Isle of Man Bank was the impact on the environment, people making more car journeys to travel to branches in Douglas. And I wonder whether you think it'd be fair to say you don't necessarily have the reputation of being an eco-warrior, given, for example, your passion for aviation.
I do my bit for the environment. My farm in St John's, we're preparing the Northwest Plan at the moment, and over half the farm is an area of ecological special interest. That indicates what we've done over the last 30 years. I drive an electric car. I don't just preach, I practice what I preach. From a house point of view, we've spent a lot of money on insulation. We've LED'd our house, and I encourage other people to do the same. So aviation is a recreational sport. I suspect my aviation passion will not save the planet if I stop doing it. And it gives me, my wife, family, and a lot of other people pleasure. So, you know, there has to be some compromise. I'm not going to go all the things that I enjoy doing.
Now, you mentioned your farm, talking about farmland. I just wonder what you make of the proposed development of around 100 houses on a greenfield site in St John's.
Abhorrent would be a good expression. Certainly nothing that I can support there at all. Obviously, it's all to do with the preparation of the Northwest Plan and the call for sites. People can put sites forward wherever they want. I think that's an inappropriate location. It doesn't grow a village or a town. It doesn't infill. It's actually development in the open countryside, something that we're trying to avoid and something that I could not possibly support.
Well, let's talk a little bit about planning, because during your period as minister, the island's planning system and procedures, they've attracted criticism really for lacking transparency. The backlog in applications is often beyond the stated aim of around 8 weeks. The vast majority of decisions are now seen to be made by unaccountable officers and not scrutinised by the planning committee. And there's been a much publicised lack of conservation officers to protect the island's built heritage. How much would you say that reflects your management of a vital aspect of the island's governance and accountability?
I think planning is criticised unfairly on occasions. So just put some things in context. We had problems with conservation officers and registration process because we couldn't recruit anyone. We did recruit someone off island. There's no one on island. We've now got someone in post, and we've got an assistant. We've provided extra resource. And during my term in this administration, we registered more buildings than they did in the previous 20 years. So I think there's a bit of a misconception about what's being achieved there. When it comes to the planning process itself, we were doing quite well with the stats until COVID came along. And that, once again, good excuse.
It does seem to be a good excuse.
But we couldn't hold face-to-face meetings. And we didn't have any legislation in place to hold non-face-to-face meetings, because they have to be public meetings. So that delayed things. But I can tell you now that over the last couple of months, we've caught up on the backlog and 80%. I don't quite go with this unaccountable, because most applications are passed. I think something like 95% of applications are actually passed. And the 80% or so that are dealt with by the officers under delegated powers are not controversial. So they are approved. The controversial ones end up before the planning committee, and that's as it should be. And that's in the public domain. Then people can see the public debate. And they're usually the larger ones or more complex ones. So we do work quite well. And when it comes to the appeal process, we had a bit of a hiatus again over the COVID period because we couldn't get any inspectors over to the island. We worked out a way of doing it virtually. And I can say that from my perspective, anything that appears on my desk, I will sign it off in 24 hours. Providing I've got the time to read the background material. So we have cleared the appeals backlog.
How happy are you, though, as a politician, that the system seems at least to have a perception that it's geared towards the wealthy and the developers rather than the average person who just wants to put an extension on their house?
Funnily enough, we get more complaints from what you call the average citizen than we do about large developments. And there are protests about larger developments and the higher value individuals. There is no favouritism in the system. It's policy driven and it can be subjective. But the problem with planning is it's adversarial. At the end of the day, there is usually a winner and a loser. If you oppose, you think you've been mistreated or not heard. If you win, then you think that the system is good and it's done what it's supposed to do. So, I don't sit in an operational capacity within the planning. I sit at the top. I try to divorce myself from planning decisions. Otherwise, there's a perception of bias because I am the ultimate appeal process, as it were. And even in that process, if you look at the number of appeals where I've overturned the inspector's decision, been very, very few. But when I have, I've had complaints that I've overturned it. And when I haven't, I have complaints that I haven't overturned it. So, you know, it's very difficult.
I just want to take you back to your 2016 manifesto and some of the points you made in there. First of all, about the economy, you said you would encourage new interests and ideas to grow the economy, to pay for all the things we want. What ideas have you brought forward in the past 5 years?
I've done quite a lot in terms of what I can within my department and supported initiatives from DfE. If you look at what we've done in the department, I said I would keep the meat plant open, and I have. And that's spawned a lot of artisanal businesses that use home provenance product. We've put provenance labels out there. And if you look at the restaurant scene till COVID bit, and also the local shop schemes or shops selling local produce, they have increased immensely. I mean, I can't remember, we put on several tens of millions of GDP and promoted or helped some 500-600 new businesses that have been created in that time. And on top of that, I've done other things where I've driven reform of the agricultural support scheme so that we now have an environmental element to it, because I did some research, or the department did some research at the beginning of the administration. It was pretty obvious that the mixed farms, which are very environmentally friendly on the Isle of Man, are not really viable without some form of subsidy. And if we want to see their environmental benefits and make them better farmers in an environmental sense, we put money into the system to help support them. So that's a little microcosm. And on top of that, the fisheries industry. One of my first crises that I faced was this race to fish and for scallops, and it was a nightmare. We were going to see no scallops. The scallop stocks were crashing, and that escalated right up to Nicola Sturgeon level when I'd said, no more, we've got to do something about this. And fortunately, we have done something about that, and that's kept the fishing industry intact, the producers as well as the processors. So, yes, I've done my bit.
What do you acknowledge that you could have done better, though, over the past 5 years?
Well, there's always something I could have done better. I'm not a perfectionist, and things sort of slip away or get away. I think the Animal Welfare Bill, which you alluded to earlier, that was a bitter disappointment. And in retrospect, maybe I should have done a bit more there. You said lobby my fellow members, but that would have helped. But I did do that, and obviously I take that as a bitter disappointment. But in terms of other things, there's always something. If I had a bit more money from Treasury or a bit more support here, I could do a bit more for people. I could do a little bit more. I mean, from the environment point of view, we look at things like peel silt and things like that. There's always more you could do. But I think generally the administration has been fairly successful. I mean, we've managed Brexit, COVID crisis. You know, they have been things that, well, Brexit was there, but COVID particularly came out of the blue. And sadly, that was very disruptive. But I think as an administration and a government and the members and the community as a whole, I mean, the Isle of Man's a fairly community-driven environment anyway, but during the crisis, it was lovely to see that. I mean, I rang people up and said, are you all right? Yes, yes, our neighbours are looking after us or what have you. And it really came together. So I was really impressed by that.
Just finally then, in 30 seconds, Geoffrey Boot, what are you promising the people of Glenfarne and Peel if you are re-elected in September?
Difficult to know what the future brings, but I would hope that I've stayed in touch. I promised I would respond to constituents' inquiries in 24 hours. I do that mostly. I've done a lot of work behind the scenes that people don't hear about. Newsletters, face-to-face surgeries, social media presence to keep people informed. That will all continue if I'm re-elected. In terms of what I will do as a government role, I don't know, because that will be dependent on who else is elected and what happens. But I'd like to think that whatever I do, it will be in recovery mode from COVID. It'll look after the community. There are things to do in Peel and Glenfarne that I will continue to drive, like the sewage works and things like that.